Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to
start?
I'll let you. Next time. I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party!
Don't say sorry. You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we're both wide awake, super bright-eyed, and definitely bushy-tailed. I'm Karen Peterson, joined by Lauren Humphreys-Brook.
I love our introductions. Like, honestly, the introductions just sometimes get more unhinged. Just like, I'm not awake. I don't know what's happening.
So. I definitely was awake more than 10 minutes ago, for sure. How are you, Lauren?
I'm good. I am awake. It is also later in the day here than it is there. So that's helpful and everything. But I'll bet it's warmer there because it's fucking cold here.
Well, our high today is only like 50, so.
Oh, actually about the same temperature then, so not too bad. Yeah. I think our high is 50 here.
It's 48 right now. It's been really nice and sunny and beautiful, and then all of a sudden today there's like a cold front and it's like freezing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say my parents and some of my friends upstate have informed me they got like 10 inches of snow.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm like, yeah, when they said that, I was just like, we have rain and it was 50 yesterday. So I'm okay with that. That's all right. Like, kind of done with the snow this year.
Yeah, no, thank you. Ugh. Anyway, so how's your week been besides cold?
Exhausting, but good. Like, got shit done. Watched some movies, enjoying myself. Yeah, what about you?
Well, see, you know, this week was my spring break, so I didn't have to work this week. Took it off and thought, oh, I'm gonna get so much done, and kind of didn't, but that's okay. it's just been a nice week to relax. I definitely did watch some stuff, so that was good, but yeah. Have you watched anything besides what we're going to talk about today? Have you watched anything of note? We haven't done this in a while. Like, anything that you want to mention?
Yeah, that's true. Well, actually, one of the films that I recently saw, not this past week, but I saw Uproar, which is kind of a small New Zealand film. I say small, but it's actually got quite a well-known cast. It's been sort of very slowly playing in theaters around the United States, and it premiered at Toronto. It's just a very good film. I 100% did not watch this solely because Rhys Darby was in it.
of course.
But the other reason why I watched it is that it also stars Julian Dennison, who is who we know from Hunt for the Wilder People. And he's grown up now, and it also includes James Rollison, who plays Boy in Boy. So it's basically, and Minnie Driver. So it's just like, oh, look, it's the entire cast from Taika Waititi's films.
Aww. And
it's just a very, very well-made film. It's one of those films that, you know, could kind of have slid into sort of maudlin territory. It's about Maori a teenager who is kind of struggling with his identity a little bit and figuring out who he actually is. And it's in the midst of this moment where I think it's like the early 80s, where New Zealand is hosting the South African rugby team. And there's a lot of protests going on because of apartheid. And this is all then feeding into the relationship between the Maori people and the kind of white powers that be. And so there's all of this conflict going on, and so but then it's told through the eyes of this kid who's like 17 years old and sort of trying to figure out who he is. He's got a white mother, his father is dead, he's got like this good relationship with a drama teacher, and he's sort of trying to figure out who he is and where he stands in all of this, in the midst of a lot of racism and a lot of complexity, etc. It's very, very well done, and if people are able to see it, I definitely go see it. I'm certain that it will get released on digital in the United States before long. So it's a very well-made film, great performances. And yeah, and I will say Rhys Darby is fucking awesome. Like he's fantastic in it.
That sounds great. I would really like to track that down. I will do that.
So what about you? Seen anything interesting?
So I've watched a couple of things. I saw two movies that are out in theaters this weekend. One is Immaculate, starring Sydney Sweeney as a nun who is apparently pregnant by Immaculate Conception. And a lot of people are going crazy about this movie, and they're like, oh, it's doing so many new things. And I'm like, isn't that all? Because I definitely got Rosemary's Baby vibes from this, and not in a blatant ripoff sort of way, like, you know, other certain filmmakers did. But it's one of those where for me watching, I was just like, all you're doing is reminding me of better movies. I thought that it did some interesting things. It definitely, I actually wrote a review, and that's on our website, but it's like religious horror is big, you know, big subgenre. Yeah. Obviously there's so much, and even when movies aren't outright religiously themed, they tend to use a lot of religious iconography. So like, yeah, if there's a haunted house, they'll have someone come in and try to bless it, even if it's not, you know, a religious family or whatever, that kind of thing. But so in this case, it's very much a religious movie. It's a nun working at a convent in Italy, but it tries to ask the question of what if it's faith itself that is really the danger here, which is a great question to ask, and I think that it could have done some very interesting things, but it focuses more on the horror and less on the storytelling, and that's where it really does the story a disservice. Because by the end it's like, yeah, you were so close, man, you were so close. But I feel like they kind of missed some opportunities, so that was too bad. So a lot of people loved it, maybe you will too. I had some real issues with it. And then speaking of movies I had real issues with, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is out this weekend too.
Christ.
And I was like, this movie is so boring. There's this thing, it happened with Afterlife too, where it's like, I think because they're so focused on the nostalgia, and I remember specifically when Jason Reitman was making the first movie, and there was all these articles and interviews he was doing and talking about how he was treating the original movie like this Bible, and you couldn't veer away from that. And even his father, who directed the first two movies, was like, it's not that. Do what you want, have some freedom. But there, it really is treated that way. And so they just become so self-serious, and these are not supposed to be serious movies. And so it ends up just boring. There's some massive continuity errors, which actually that I got a kick out of, because I was just like, you realize you just messed up your entire story here, right? But yeah, it's not very good. And Kumail Nanjiani is just like, he's sort of the Rick Moranis sort of version for this movie. And he didn't work. He just ended up being like just a really annoying version of the character he plays in basically everything. And they try to introduce this queer storyline with Phoebe, who is played by McKenna Grace. And that one had so much potential, but it felt like another example of we're going to just dangle this carrot and we're just going to say it's a queer storyline without ever actually doing anything about that. And something that can be very easily dismissed when we are trying to get, you know, distribution in other countries.
There's so much conflict about like that, because on the one hand you're going like, yeah, it's a good thing when big franchises, big companies, etc., are like introducing queer characters. And I do think there's an argument to be made for, you know, not treating it as a big deal, right? But at the same time, you can't do that. It's still queer baiting. Like, it's right. you can't do that and be like, oh no, we have a queer character, we're inclusive and everything. It's just like, but that's not how it works. Like the way to do that is like, is for it not to be a big deal, but if for it to be a part of the story, right? You can't just sort of hint at it or be like, oh, there's a little bit of this, but we can easily cut it out.
Well, and that's, yeah, it's like, it's, this is somewhere in the middle. It's really weird because to me, it's very obvious that it's a queer story. But because nothing really happens, it's just like, I'm able to infer what they're talking about. That's where it's like this, it definitely does feel like queer baiting. And it's one where they go just far enough that it's like really easy for them to be like, no, obviously this is queer. It's like, okay, but like, mm-hmm.
It's at this point, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to watch. And I'm just kind of, you know, and I've said earlier that shows like Our Flag Means Death and Good Omens have kind of remade my brain in a lot of ways. But at this point, I'm just like, I just don't care. Like, if you're mm-hmm. going to play this game, I'm not giving you points for it. Like, I might've given you points for it 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but not now.
Yeah.
And it's tiring. And yeah, they want like, you know, accolades, be like, but we're not really going to, you know, challenge the most boring people on the fucking planet anymore.
Right.
And yeah, I'm tired of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. And then one other thing, sorry. One other thing I wanted to mention that I watched is a new limited docuseries. It's on Max. It came out this weekend. It's called Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV. And this is specific to the rise of Nickelodeon in the late 90s and into the 2000s and deals very heavily with the Dan Schneider era. And it's very compelling. It's very infuriating. It's pretty well done series. It's four episodes. Each one's about 45 minutes, but it really gets into what was going on in those days on those sets and some of the very specific overt dangers that were happening, like when there were actual pedophiles hired to work on the sets on these shows. And it's interesting, too, because it definitely finds fault with Dan Schneider, who was creepy, but it also is very clear that like he didn't specifically do things and he wasn't the only problem. So it's not all just against him. It's really about the whole culture that was able to exist in this world where you have mm-hmm. grown-ups making TV for kids that is also for grown-ups. It's a very interesting series.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Sorry, what were you about to say?
No, I was just going to say it's one of those things where because I grew up with that generation of Nickelodeon, obviously, mm-hmm. like that was my, and I because of the way that television worked out in my household, I didn't watch tons of Nickelodeon shows, but I did watch a good bit of them. And so listening to that, it's just like, oh God.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, the things that, and it doesn't surprise me at all looking back on it, but at the same time, just say, oh, they're by childhood, bye.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, that was all way after my time. I remember I was in high school babysitting kids who were into the early days of that, like Clarissa Explains It All and those shows. But yeah. Then I was out of college and it was like my friend's kids were into and my nephew too were into like Drake and Josh and mm-hmm. Victorious and those shows. And so it's like I would catch little pieces of them if I'd happen to be at somebody's house. And so I would see little bits and I'd be like, what? Why is this on a kid's show? But, you know, I wouldn't really think much of it. But mm-hmm. watching this, I was just like, holy crap. Like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And Drake Bell actually has basically a whole episode where he breaks down what happened to him. And it's horrifying. And just like it takes so much bravery to talk about your experiences like that. And the fact mm-hmm. that he was able to do that on camera was just wow. Like really just man, I was it just made me feel so sad for him. And it also, because I mean, you know, he's someone who, as he went into adulthood, he had problems with alcohol and drugs. He had arrests. He had some other things that happened, and it just reiterates something that you and I have talked about a bunch on here about like former child stars growing up and just having all these problems. And it's like everybody acts like it's the kid. Oh, they were just, you know, this privileged brat who grew up with just too mm-hmm. much. And it's like, no, I think they're probably self-medicating from some really horrible things that happened. And that's essentially what Drake Bell is talking about too. Uh-huh. So it's just, yeah, it's horrible.
Well, and you hear all of those stories so much, and almost always, like, if you find out about someone who's had major issues like that, and then you go back a little bit, it's just like, oh yeah, I think that we're going to find out something about this, mm-hmm. and it's never their fault. Of course not; they were kids,
right?
And yeah, the whole like child star burnout is very suspect, because like yeah. you know, if it's one person every once in a while, that's one thing. If it's a whole bunch, like if it's a trope at this point. Mm-hmm. If it's a whole bunch, that says something about at least the industry and about things that were happening to them that we have no awareness of.
Right.
And then
you would think on a set of a kid's show that's surrounded by kids and presumably surrounded by parents and teachers that it would be safer, but it's not. Uh-huh. And yeah, and that's the thing. There's actually, sorry, I'm going way long on this. I didn't intend to, but there's actually a part where they ask, you know, all these different former child stars who participated in it. Like, do you think, like, would you allow your kids to go into acting? Do you think it's a safe place for kids? And Drake, who's the one who suffered the most, at least that talked about it, he was just like, you know, I think that's a difficult question to answer, because it's really not about the being a child star, being an actor, that was the problem. It was that nobody was protecting me.
Well, that's the thing. We've talked about this before, that like the need for really having layers of protection mm-hmm. In Hollywood that is not, it seems to be happening more now, but is still not at the place that they need to be. Like, it's more about legality than right. it is about like actually taking care of the kids, right? And so I'm certain you've got kids that probably have very good experiences, because they have a good set. They have good, you know, parents who are really watching out for them. They have like an entire system that is looking out for them. But that still seems to be not the norm. And it really should be. And also parents shouldn't like be having to watch their kid every, they should be able to trust that the people, that the adults on set are actually looking after their kid. They shouldn't have to watch over them every single minute.
Right.
And so then you, cause it's very easy then to blame the parents. Oh, why did you do this to your child? Just like, well, I didn't, it was someone else that did it to them.
Right. But so much of the time though, what's happening is these kids are making a lot of money, and often they're mm-hmm. they're the breadwinner for the family. And so this is a big part of the problem, is that like you have parents that are willing to basically trade their child, to pay the rent, you know? So it's like, once you have money involved, and this is part of why the studios just do exactly and only what is required, is because there's money involved, you know? And so that's the biggest issue, is when you have just so much money for, you know, that these kids are responsible for, not just their own incomes, but for entire productions, it becomes very easy to just, you know, ignore certain things. You know, it's very rare to have mm-hmm. a kid who actually makes it out of that without problems and goes into adulthood. You know, Dakota Fanning and Elle Fanning are extremely rare examples. And I think it's because their parents were very much like, we're not going to let you become that stereotypical child star. You know, mm-hmm. they were involved and they didn't, you know, they didn't rely on their kids. They allowed it to be their thing, but they didn't. You know, mm-hmm. they didn't make it about themselves, which I think is one of the big problems, is too many parents do that. So anyway, it's a very good series. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
If you have the stomach for it.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, because the actual abuse is one part of what's happening. A lot of it is really just the, you know, it gets into the way that the kids were. I mean, sorry, the sexual abuse. There's other ways to abuse people. And that's a big part of it. And then just also just the way these kids were over-sexualized and for adults to laugh about, really. So anyway. So let's talk about something more fun.
Shall we? I was gonna say, heavy shit there, Karen. Jeez.
I know. Sorry about that. Let's see. Did I watch anything else that was like lighter? No, I really didn't. other than what we're going to talk about. So let's just jump right in, shall we? Yeah. So it's still Women's History Month.
And it is.
We still want to talk about awesome women. And so we thought this week, someone that we both love and have kind of wanted to do an episode on for a while is Thelma Ritter, who was a remarkable character actress. She was nominated for 6 Academy Awards and over her career. And even in roles where she didn't have a lot of screen time, she pretty much always made an impact. She's a very memorable person. She was born in Brooklyn in 1902.
Woo!
And
you can tell she was born in Brooklyn too. That woman is from Brooklyn. Like,
well, it made me wonder, like, where was she born? Was she born in the hospital that you now live in as an apartment?
she could have been. She could have. If she was Jewish, she very well might have been. Like, actually, I don't know if she was.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah. A lot of people were born. I think Barbara Streisand was actually born in the hospital that I live in now.
That's so funny. See, there you go. That's crazy. Anyway, so yeah, so she got her start on the stage and did some theater, and then she eventually moved into film. Her first role was in the movie Miracle on 34th Street. She played a mom. I remember this scene so well. She played a mom who is trying to find a toy, and Kris Kringle tells her, well, we don't have it here. Go over to Macy's or Gimbel's or whatever. They're at Macy's, tells her to go to Gimbel's. That's like a very, very key scene in that movie. Anyway, and then she, from there, it was just kind of, she was off to the races, and she did all kinds of film work. In lots of different types of movies. She was in comedies, she was in dramas, and like I said, she was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, and we're going to talk about a couple of her roles today. We've already talked about a couple movies that she's been in, but we were talking about them with other performers. So she was, for example, she was in Pick Up on South Street. She was in The Misfits. Some of her other roles, she was in, let's see, The Farmer Takes a Wife, A Letter to Three Wives, Pillow Talk, and How the West Was Won. So some very notable movies. But today we're going to specifically talk about All About Eve from 1950. Birdman of Alcatraz from 1962, and Rear Window from... I forgot what year that was in.
It's 1954.
54. There we go. So that's what we're talking about today. And because she's a character actress, not a big star of any of these movies, we actually thought it would be kind of fun to talk about these films from her character's perspective. So that's what we're going to do. So we're going to start with All About Eve from 1950, directed and written by Joseph Mankiewicz. And All About Eve was the big film that year. It was nominated, I think, for 13 Academy Awards. It's tied for the most Oscars.
Something unholy. For 14 nominations.
Yeah, 14. That's right. It's still like has the record. It's tied for the most nominations for any film ever. It did win Best Picture that year, and this is the acting nominations it got. Lead actresses Anne Baxter and Betty Davis both nominated, but neither won because I think they, you know, canceled each other out basically. And then Best Supporting Actor George Sanders, he won that year. And then two supporting actresses, Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter. So you have 5 acting nominations for one film is just insane. So Anyway, but yeah, so anybody who doesn't know what All About Eve is about, shame on you, and go watch it right now and come back.
But how have you not seen All About Eve? Like, right? it's one of the films.
Yeah, like you watch All About Eve, like everybody has seen this. But I know there's probably some people who are living under a rock and haven't. So seriously, just like stop what you're doing, turn this off, go watch it, come back in 2.5 hours. It'll be worth it, I promise. But anyway, it is about Bette Davis plays Margot Channing, who is a Broadway star who has just been at the height of her career. But the problem is that she's now 40 and her you know, her roles are changing. Her performances are changing. And along comes Anne Baxter as Eve Harrington, who is a young fan who just kind of maneuvers her way into Margot's circle. And basically kind of takes over and gets into her life and eventually works her way into her own acting career. Thelma Ritter plays a very good friend and confidant, I guess, to Margot, who she herself started off as a vaudeville star. And eventually her work dried up. And now she's basically Margot's dresser and assistant and whatever else she needs. And she also is the voice of reason.
I love Thelma Ritter in this one because, I mean, just generally, you always know when Thelma Ritter is in a film. Like, she's so, like, even Miracle on 34th Street, like, as soon as I read, oh, she was in Miracle on 34th, yes, I remember her. Like, she's such a, she really is one of those character actresses that as soon as, like, you hear her voice, you're like, that's Thelma Ritter. I know where she is. She's here somewhere. Mm-hmm. And she really does, like, not command the screen, but she is just a presence. And especially in something like All About Eve, where you've got, I mean, it's a stacked cast. It really is. It's a remarkable group of actors, actually. And so you've got her in these scenes with Bette Davis and Anne Baxter and George Sanders, et cetera. And she is just never dominating, but always very, very present. And fun to watch, because she does kind of have this rolling commentary on what's happening, and she clocks what's going on fairly quickly. She doesn't trust Eve. She doesn't trust everything that is happening, and she even, if I remember correctly, she even warns Margot a couple of times, like, this isn't right, like, something's off here. And Margot's like, oh no, don't worry about it. It's just like, no, something, nope, I don't like it. But then she just kind of is like, well, if you want to fuck you up your life, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was watching it again last night. I hadn't watched it in a while. And I, because of the fact that I knew we were going to be talking specifically about Thelma today, I was watching the film, like, really looking for her and really looking for all the subtleties in her performance. And you really do see it right from the beginning. As soon as Eve is brought into the room, and just starts her whole story about how her life was changed when she saw Margot on the stage and in San Francisco and had nothing else going for her. And she tells this whole story about how she ended up there in New York, you know, watching her perform night after night. And as soon as she kind of is done and leaves the room and it's just Margot and
Birdie.
Thank you. It's just Margot and Birdie left. And Margot's just like, oh, that poor kid. And Birdie's just sitting there like, yeah, sure, that poor kid. And, like, not only does she clock it right away, she's been around the stage for so long. Like, I mean, she was from vaudeville and now we're in the 1950s. And so she's been around this for so long that she knows a performance. It's not just that she's really good at reading people. She's really good at understanding actors and how actors perform. And so she's able to just see it right away. And then from there, I mean, she calls it out. Margot, of course, dismisses her. But from there, every time you see her, even if she's not actually speaking in a scene or talking about her thoughts, you can see it. You can read it on her face. Her facial expressions are so perfect. because she's just conveying exactly what she's thinking. And it's really, really great character work from her. But she also does just have some great lines too. It's she's very well written as well.
Yeah, it's that very acerbic humor and they said that knowingness, like she knows what's going on. And you get that from her. And so she's humorous, but she also has a weight to her. And that's true again for a lot of her roles, that there a lot of her roles are humorous. Like she's kind of this commentator on the events. She sees things better than everybody else. But that adds weight to her characters because she's not a clown, right? She's not like she's only there to provide comic relief. She's actually there to sort of, at least in All About Eve, she's almost like this window for the audience as well, because the audience clocks to a certain degree what Eve is doing. We're already because we know the opening, right? We're already conditioned to sort of mistrust Eve. And we've got this character who sees her for the first time and is just like, nope, she's up to something. Isn't it convenient, basically? And she kind of expresses all of those sort of elements of the plot that you're like, yeah, it is pretty fucking convenient. It definitely is.
Yeah. One of the things I like about her too, just on that subject of her not just being there for comic relief, is she also understands her own place in the story too. And so like there's a scene, it's after the party, and I think it's after, maybe it's before the party. Sorry, now I can't think of when it is, but Margot is laying on her bed and Birdie comes in and they're talking, and Margot says, "You don't like Eve, do you?" And Birdie says, "Are you looking for an answer or an argument?" And Margot says, "An answer." And Birdie says, "No." And so then Margot persists, "Well, why don't you like her?" And she goes, "Well, now you want an argument." and it's one of those things where it's like, it's funny because we understand the subtext of what's happening there and we understand what they're talking about, but it's also very serious. Birdie is taking this situation seriously, and it's just so well done. And it's great. You also just get these like moments of, without having to get into their history, you see the length of this relationship between Margot and Birdie.
Well, and it could have so easily been kind of played off as like a jealousy, that, you know, Eve is kind of supplanting Birdie at some level, but I never get that impression from Ritter's performance. If anything, it's protectiveness. It's realizing like, this is what's happening. Right. But it's also this awareness that she can't force Margot to see it. Right. And she can't protect her. She can say, here's the reality of what's going on. But she's not going to kind of push herself in and say like, you know, you have to get rid of this girl, et cetera. But she's very, so it's a good balance, and it doesn't slide into, I think that again, we as the audience trust her because we don't see her being jealous.
Right.
We don't see her being like, oh, Mark, you know, I don't like this woman because of the way that she's behaving with you, and I feel like I'm being supplanted. And that could have happened so easily. And it happens a little bit more with the Celeste Holm character, where she is kind of and for good reason too. But Birdie is a very reliable narrator, basically. Her perceptions are very reliable.
Yeah. It's also, this maybe sounds silly, but it's also kind of good life advice for us, you know? Like, how often have you been in a situation where you see your friend making just really bad choices, and you know that's a bad choice, but like, so many times people just jump in, oh, I have to stop them, I have to intervene. And it's like, no. A lot of times we just have to let our friends make their own mistakes and like be there and kind of let them know, I don't think you should trust that, but also not just jump in and stop them.
Yeah, it's one of those that's always very hard to do. And I think it comes with age as well, where you're like, oh, I can see the pattern. I see it. Oh, I wish you could see it.
Yep.
But it's never going to work actually you know, trying to interfere or definitely really expressing your opinion, which is, I don't like this person.
Right.
And then you get into a fight. So it's like, well, why don't you like them? All of that.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too with Birdie is because of the fact that she never goes so far as to just give a laundry list of like, yeah, this is all the reasons that Eve is terrible and why you're going to regret this friendship. She doesn't do that. And so because of that, it does not damage their relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It again, it doesn't slide into those accusations of like, oh, you're being jealous. You're, you just don't like her because she's young. You don't like her because she's this or that, or because she's paying attention to me, all of that stuff. It very deftly evades some of those other elements. And again, keeps her very reliable because she is going to be there in the background. She is going to be present when the shit hits the fan, as it were. And she,
yeah.
And there's also this, because these are actors, and because Margot has been a star for so long, there's a little bit of a sense that things like this have happened before. Not exactly this, but you know, those people that you trust that you shouldn't, and that your friend from a distance. I mean, I've had this experience with friends as well. Just like, I don't know how you cannot see what's going on, right? And really at the end of the day, all you can do is kind of be there for them and pick up the pieces and not say I told you so.
Right. Yeah. Oh, such a good movie. Any other thoughts about All About Eve?
Although Birdie did tell her so.
Birdie definitely did tell her so, but Birdie's not the kind of person to say I told you so.
Yeah.
Which is part of why I love her. And that's the thing. And this is where it's like watching it. It reminds me, maybe this sounds really dumb after everything that we've been talking about, but it does remind me a little bit of me and my role in some of my friendships too, where it's just like, I don't have to tell you I told you so because you know that I did. You know?
Don't you dare gloat. I am gloating quietly.
I don't have to gloat. They know.
You know. Who should you have listened to? Me. You should have listened to me.
Yeah.
I've definitely never told my friends Lauren is always right, but but I've thought it. Oh, look, Lauren was right.
When people do tell me, oh, you were right, I'm like, I usually am.
It's like, true, I was, yes.
Yeah.
We are all Thelma Ritter.
Oh, yep. It's true. All right. Any other thoughts about All About Eve?
As you said, I mean, if anyone hasn't seen All About Eve, see it. Like, it is one of the quintessential films.
Oh, yeah. It's so good. So good. It's one of those, it's like, you know, and this is the thing, every year when the Oscars come around and people get all upset about what does and doesn't get nominated and who wins, or like we look back in history, I can't believe this person didn't win for this, and then you look at what it was nominated against. I mean, 1950 was also the Sunset Boulevard year, so it was just like, that's some stiff competition. Yeah. And two movies that deal with very similar themes but do them in very different ways. It's fascinating. So anyway, okay, so I actually want to, normally we go in release order, but I want to jump to Birdman of Alcatraz next and close it out with Rear Window. I'm glad you put it that way on the agenda. We didn't even talk about that. But yeah, so Birdman of Alcatraz, this was from 1962. And this is a biopic about the Birdman of Alcatraz, who was Robert Stroud. Ironically, he never got to have birds at Alcatraz, but anyway, he was a convict. He was convicted of manslaughter, was sent to prison when he was young, and ended up killing a guard while he was there and getting life in prison. And while he's serving in solitary, essentially, he ends up saving a bird. And this begins passion, a lifelong pursuit, I guess, where he becomes a very renowned ornithologist and which is also sort of this rehabilitation for him. Robert Stroud never was released from prison. He did spend the rest of his life there. In fact, he died 2 years after the movie came out. But Thelma Ritter plays his mother. And again, with not a lot of screen time, but very effective whenever she's present. And she was also not, this was her, I think, final Oscar nomination was for this film. So she also, by the way, she was nominated 6 times, but never actually won an Academy Award. So what are your thoughts about Birdman of Alcatraz? Which, sorry, this also stars Burt Lancaster, Carl Malden, Betty Field, Telly Savalas, Hugh Marlowe is apparently just going to be a person that I see in a lot of movies this year. It's like every time I turn something on now, it's like, oh, Hugh Marlowe is back. Okay. So what are your thoughts about Birdman of Alcatraz?
Well, again, with that stacked cast, this was actually the first time I'd seen Birdman of Alcatraz. And I do think it has to be said that according to actual history, this is not accurate whatsoever.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that, you know, we're going to leave history aside for a little bit. But it's an incredibly well-made film. And it really is about prison life, prison reform, what rehabilitation actually is, that kind of thing. And that's really the project of the film. When it comes to Thelma Ritter's character, I did expect her to be in it more, given that she was nominated for an Oscar for this. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, she is one of those actresses who, when she is on screen, she is so present and is so recognizable and gives this performance. One of the things I really like about the early part of the film is that we get this like background information about his attachment to his mother, and how important she is. Like, one of the first things that happens is, like, he almost gets into a fight with a fellow inmate because the inmate, like, touched her picture, right? Picked up her picture. And so you've got this kind of, it's this relationship where you're like, what is going on there, essentially? And then we see more of her, and we see both her support of him, but then also the way in which she is so enmeshed in his life, to the point that, you know, when she essentially feels like he's cheating on her, right?
Yeah.
She completely changes her tune about his release. She stops advocating for him, all of this. And so you've got very few scenes with her, but all of them, like, build this emotional relationship between her and Burt Lancaster. And then it you know, eventually culminates in her kind of refusing to speak for him after that. When he gets married, and suddenly this woman is kind of invading her life as far as she's concerned and supplanting her at some level. And it's interesting because this is all happening in relationship to a man who is in prison for life, right? And it does come up for parole a couple of times. But there is this, throughout the film, there's this very fatalistic, you know, sensation. And it's because of the way the film begins, right? But this fatalistic sensation that he is going to be there forever. This is his life, and this will be his life forever. And so the connections that he has between people on the outside are very tenuous. But his relationship with his mother is the major connection that then kind of shifts when he gets married, and shifts when she decides that she's no longer going to be a part of his life. And you feel kind of that abandonment because the emotional weight of their relationship has been so powerful.
Yeah. I think because of the way that the story is introduced, with this writer who is basically waiting at the dock at Alcatraz to see him. And we know there's a narration running through and everything, so we know that he does not get released. So when we go into the story and we see all the way back to the beginning of his incarceration, every time there are these opportunities for parole, or these, you know, these challenges or whatever, we know that it's not going to prevail. So that's not where the drama is, like, waiting for these answers. It's more of the why is he not getting released. What are the other situations around that? And so much of it is really in especially in the early parts, when you see Thelma Ritter as Mrs. Stroud, so much of the drama and the emotional stuff there is for her really fighting for him. And so, yeah, when we see that turn later, it doesn't feel it's not a big argument. It's not loud. It's not shouting. It's just very sad. And you just really feel the weight of even his own mother turning her back on him, basically. And so much of that credit goes to Thelma Ritter for her performance, because she really is someone who just has so much power in short bits of dialogue and monologue, but also her character gets to develop even more when she's not even on screen through letters. And we don't even hear her reading the letters. It's, you know, him, but just getting, that's part of why you almost don't notice how little she's actually on screen, because we feel so connected to her through their written communication too.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. She's very much a presence. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when you get the scene where she's basically like, you know, you're abandoning me, how dare you, kind of thing, you understand how intense that relationship has been.
Yeah.
And it's this major break. It's this moment of like, you know, she's leaving him, basically. Like, it's and it's such a weird thing, because you know, like, you know, he's there forever. But it's still that there's still that break happening, and it's sad. It's sorrowful. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly emotional.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something too that is handled very carefully, handled with a lot of consideration in the script and the way that it's staged. This very easily could feel like a very creepy relationship between a mother and a son.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, to me at least. It's much closer than it should be, but it's also understandable how that could happen given the circumstances. And it's never, I mean, yes, they definitely do go through basically a breakup, which on one level is disturbing, there's not that underlying, like, there's not an underlying sense of this being something deeper than that for either of them. It's really mm-hmm. just, that's just how close they are and how enmeshed they are in each other's lives and circumstances. And I feel like it's a very careful balance, and they find that balance really well.
Well, and some of it, I think, is we'd never see flashbacks. We don't right. get what their relationship was when he was out of prison. Mm-hmm. We never, so it isn't a biopic in the sense that we're not getting his backstory. We're not getting, like, we get enough information about his upbringing and about what he did to get imprisoned in the first place, to kind of understand who he is and where his character is coming from. But we don't get, you know, direct flashbacks to it.
Right.
And so we don't watch that kind of that, the development of whatever that relationship was. But it's very much implied that she's probably a single mother, that she probably raised him without much help from anybody else, that, you know, she has this strong attachment to him and who he is, and he has a very strong attachment to her. And then he gets in prison, and like she goes from Alaska to Leavenworth to visit him, right? And isn't allowed in because it's Saturday and it's not visiting day. So that's the other thing that, you know, in a lot of ways her character functions as, is kind of highlighting the cruelty of the prison system.
Yeah.
And the fact that this one, for a while, this one and only connection that he has to the outside world, and his home is thousands of miles away, right? The only connection that he has to the outside world is his mother. And because it's the wrong day, she shows up on the wrong day, he's not allowed to see her.
Mm-hmm.
Because he gets angry about that, he's not allowed to see her. Like, it's this, it like creates the sensation of like, you know, what is this actually about? This isn't about rehabilitation. This isn't about helping someone become a better person so that they can exist outside. This is about punishment.
Right.
And it's arbitrary punishment too. You're not towing the line. You're not behaving in the way we tell you have to behave. And because of that, we're going to keep on punishing you and keep on trying to break you. And it's very much filtered through that initial relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And so much of the film really does expose this. Like, we talked about the movie The Big House from 1930. We talked about that a while back, and how in 1930 they were making movies about the desperate need for prison reform. And I think that this is another example, and they do it under the guise of, oh, we're going to tell you a story about this particular prisoner who, sure, he was locked up for murder. So not the best of people, but in telling his story, they definitely are really highlighting what that prison life is like, and how it's really not, as much as people want to say that it's about rehabilitation, it's about, you know, trying to help people to, so that they don't commit crimes again and whatever. It's really not about that. That's a platitude that people love to talk about, but that's not really what their goals are. And you really see that through Carl Malden's character as this warden, who just decides right away that he hates Robert Stroud. And he's just determined to make this man's life miserable because he won't play the game, and tells him, I'm going to make sure that you stay in solitary your whole life. And even later, toward the end of the movie, when they have another conversation, he's like, oh, I was considering petitioning to, like, not have you be by yourself, not have you be in solitary anymore. But, you know, then this happened and I changed my mind. And it's like, were you ever really thinking about it? You know, like, you probably weren't.
Yeah.
But so, yeah.
So much of the film is about the conflict between the two of them and this, like, personal vendetta, right? That is formed. But also this weird kind of almost friendship where they, because I think Stroud is spending so much of his time in solitary that he's not having a lot of connections to people outside. That relationship is just like, oh, hey, it's my old buddy, you know, kind of thing.
Well, certainly the warden treats it like that. He tries to be all buddy-buddy with him, even when he's being terrible, you know?
Well, and they have that final conversation where Stroud, you know, is writing a manuscript about the prison system. And the warden, like, reads it, and he's like, you know, how dare you, basically. And it's a fantastic argument because they really do just tear into each other. In a very polite way. And you know, and Stroud very much points out, like, this is what you've dedicated your life to, and it is a failure. You know, you don't want to help people. You don't want to fix anything. You don't want to make people's lives better. You want to hurt us, and you want to punish us, and you want us to be in your control. And I do think, you know, I mentioned earlier that this is not accurate in terms of the life of Robert Stroud or anything like that. But I think that what the film does, the whole point of it, is exactly that, the dehumanization and the disconnection that, you know, prison actually does to people. And these kind of interpersonal relationships where you've got a warden who's decided you are irredeemable, and decides it very early on and never shifts his perspective for, you know, whatever, 20 years.
Right.
It's a very long time. And so it's this buildup of, like, animosity and everything. And in the midst of this, you know, we're watching Stroud being caring and taking care of these birds and taking care of other prisoners as well. You've got the relationship between him and the Telly Savalas character. All of that stuff kind of building up and forming these connections in the midst of a system that wants him to not have connections and that wants him to not be human.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he even helps end a rebellion at Alcatraz, like a big prison riot. He helps bring that to an end. And still, he's always treated like someone who's not fit to be in society because of something that happened many years before. And it does ask some questions about, you know, the way that we look at, does someone who commits a murder when they're 19, 20 years old, like, what is right for these folks, you know, like, is it, you have to be careful because you can't just trust somebody to go out into the general population and not do that again. But also, can you not trust them? Like, it's really tricky. And I think I think watching this film, it does a good job of kind of noting the complexities of the situation, but also, especially in that final conversation between Stroud and Shoemaker, it also really helps you see the imbalance of power between the two, and how no matter what Stroud ever does, no matter what he is able to accomplish from behind bars, he's never going to convince this man, or probably anybody else, at least in this era, that he's worthy to give it a try again in society.
Yeah, and it also points out the issues of recidivism and the fact that prisoners are not, you know, in that era, and honestly in this era, are not being prepared to live outside of that. And are, you know, people who are like kind of entrapped in this because it's a violent system, because it's a system that isn't forgiving.
Right.
And isn't interested. That, you know, again, is that it's not really interested in rehabilitation. And that's one of the things that Shoemaker, you know, even says, like, you've never shown any desire to be rehabilitated. It's like, I've been watching this entire film. He is taking care of fucking baby birds. Like,
yeah,
I don't know what you want about rehabilitation. Like, his own, jailer, the one of the guards that he like has a strong relationship with and really likes him. Like, he kind of goes like, yeah, like, this guy is not bad, right? He's not a bad person. He is being rehabilitated by himself without anyone's help, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's that human kind of kindness and need to take, you know, taking care of these little birds and, you know, learning about them and figuring out how to take care of them. And then, you know, we've got this warden who's saying, like, you've never shown any remorse. It's just like, are you kidding me? Like, I don't know what you want.
Right. Yeah. Well, and in that conversation, too, where they talk about the recidivism issue, it brings up a point that I guess, it makes sense, but I hadn't really, like, consciously thought about before, which was, because we tend to talk about recidivism as like, well, these guys just, you know, they don't know anything better, or they don't have any prospects, so they, you know, repeat offend and go back to prison. But he also brings up the point, Stroud does, brings up the point of like how they are treated in prison is so bad that they are not emotionally, psychologically capable of handling life in the outside world. And I thought, wow, that's such a good point that I hadn't really considered in that way before.
Yeah, it becomes, you know, one of the major topics. It's really sad that this film made in 1962 still applies so well today, mm-hmm. because a lot of the discussions about prison reform are exactly that. Like, you can't simply put someone in prison for 5 years or 3 years or 1 year and then let them go into the outside world with nothing else.
Right.
That's and yeah, and of course a large proportion of them are going to simply go right back in. And when you're talking about people who have been in prison for 10 or 15 or 20 years and then are being sent back into the world, yeah, of course they're not emotionally prepared for it. Of course they, you know, there's this whole argument that some people want to go back to prison because that's something they recognize now. It's mm-hmm. a safe space.
Right.
And that's not, you know, again, it isn't. At that point, it's like, you're not doing this for human beings. What are you doing it for? And the film raises that question very, very clearly. And it's still a film that was made, God, what, 50 years ago?
Like 60 years ago.
60 years ago now, and we're still having these conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. And through it all, just to bring it back to our topic of the day, through it all, once Thelma Ritter's character as Mrs. Stroud, once she does exit, essentially, she disowns him. You not only is she not there for him, but we really feel as an audience, we really feel how she's missing from the story. And it's again, credit to her, but also very well written, that we really feel her absence once she's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
Any other thoughts about Birdman of Alcatraz?
It is a very good film. It's on Tubi, it if is. Anybody wants to see it. And it is a long film. It is very well worth it.
Yeah, it's about 2.5 hours, mm-hmm. just about. So, but yeah, very good. And that's going to bring us to our final film today, which is not one she was nominated for an Academy Award for, but should have been. And that is Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window from 1954, starring Jimmy Stewart, and who is very mad because Grace Kelly wants to marry him. Poor guy. Life is so hard. Anyway.
I think Jimmy Stewart actually did, like, there's some quote from him that's just like, I had a really difficult role. I had to pretend to be a man who did not want to marry Grace Kelly.
Yep. And anyway, so James Stewart, he plays a photographer, like a very famous photojournalist, basically.
Yeah.
Who is confined to a wheelchair because he has a broken leg and he has nothing to do in his Greenwich Village apartment besides look out the window and stare at all his neighbors and make up stories about what's happening in their lives. And his girlfriend is Grace Kelly, who wants to marry him, and he's mad about it for real. And Thelma Ritter is someone who's coming in daily to take care of him and make sure that he eats and that his, you know, he gets the care that he needs anyway. And then one night he thinks he might see a murder happening across the way in a neighbor's apartment. And so he kind of gets Stella and Lisa involved in trying to figure out what's really going on and trying to solve a murder. He ends up calling his police detective friend and it becomes a big thing. So this is an Alfred Hitchcock film. So this was very well known. One of the better known Hitchcocks, I would say.
Yes, it's one of the big ones.
Yes, it's been oft not remade, but copied.
Repeated. Yes, it's very much a, in a lot of ways, it's one of those films that's treated almost like a cliche at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, because this movie did so well and because it's so so fascinating and just such a fun little mystery thriller, it has been the subject of a lot of what's the word I'm looking for?
Parody?
Yeah.
Reference?
Yeah.
Intertextual referentiality?
There's a lot of versions. Yeah, there's a lot of versions of the story. Of course, the good one is The Burbs because it's a comedy and it's great and Tom Hanks is in it, but... And we've talked about that one on here, but there's lots of other versions of it too. Anyway, but this one is the OG and it's great. It is based on a story from 1942, but what are your thoughts about Rear Window?
Oh, what are my thoughts about Rear Window?
What are a couple of your thoughts about Rear Window?
It's just in reference to the actress that we're actually talking about today. One of the things that I love generally about a lot of Hitchcock's films is that, you know, he loves supporting players. And mm-hmm. one of the things that he does so well throughout his career from the beginning of like his British films all the way through to the end is he gets a very good cast of supporting actors. And that's definitely one of the things that he has done here. Thelma Ritter is so... Again, you know, that grounding presence, that kind of, she's also, you know, one of the things we haven't really talked about, she's a working class figure, usually.
Yeah.
She's very often playing maids, dressers, you know, people who are kind of from the streets, as it were. And, but she's got that very sort of Brooklyn, right, sharpness and wit and intelligence. And she kind of cuts through the bullshit. And one of the things that I really like about her work in this particular film is she has a lot of conversations with Jeff, L.B. Jeffries, played by Jimmy Stewart, about like his relationship with Lisa and about the things that he's up to. And she's just like, oh, just stop, like, you know, making up all of this shit. Like, you want each other, so you get married. That's what you do. there is the sensation of, like, you know, he's kind of psychologizing it and talking about, like, well, here's why I can't marry her. And, you know, we're just not compatible in our lives. Just like, oh, that's bullshit. Like, And she's got some great lines about, like, her and her husband, where they have been together for, you know, 40 years or whatever, and they drive each other crazy, but they love one another, because that's just what you do. and Hitchcock has a really good sensibility about characters like that. And she fits, like, slots into that position so well, where she is kind of the comic relief, but she's also, again, much as her, in her performance in All About Eve, she does just kind of cut through everything and say, this is silly. Like, why is this argument even happening?
Yeah.
Be grown-ups and recognize, you know, that this is an adult relationship and this is the relationship that you should be in. And so it's a very smart and fun and likable role. And she kind of acts as this third point of this triangle that's going on, where she's kind of looking at the two of them and going, like, what is even happening? Like, stop bullshitting each other, basically.
Yeah. Well, and I love that. I mean, her character of Stella here is similar in a lot of ways to Birdie from All About Eve, but What I love is that there are differences in how the characters are written and how she approaches them too. Whereas with Birdie, because she has this long relationship with Margot, she holds back on things until she's specifically asked her opinion. In Rear Window, like, she doesn't have this decades of friendship with Jeff. So she's just like, dude, you're an idiot. And also, he's a boy and not a girl, you know? And she's just like, you're stupid. She's beautiful. Just make this happen. Like, what are you waiting for? And I love that she just is very, very blunt about her opinions in this, in ways that she doesn't need to be in other films. So, yeah. And it does make her a lot of fun. And I love just watching how she goes from just this whole thing is silly to being very easily embroiled in this same mystery with Jeff and getting really caught up in the stories that he's kind of made up about his neighbors. And some of it may or may not be true. He doesn't know, but he's a photojournalist. So he has a good sense of how to read people and situations too. So it's not like he's just making this up because, you know, part of it is because he's bored, but he also is coming to it with a little bit of insight and knowledge that other people in his situation might not have. But it's very easy for her to just get caught up in this too. And it's so fun to watch that happen as she gets more and more just, like, curious about it and starts watching with him. And
She gets increasingly invested in what's happening. And even in like some of the very early scenes together, she asks him about the neighbors. She's just like, oh, so what's going on over there? and there is that, you know, that gossipy element, I think, that is very much a part of the film, because it is about spying on your neighbors, right? Mm-hmm. He's sitting there, he's looking out the window, he's a photographer, so he's creating this narrative about each of these people, and we're being shown it. The viewer is also in the midst of that experience.
Yeah.
And it's very much the way that, like, photojournalists tell a story through images.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much. Yeah. They remind me of, you know, my grandmother, especially. The house that they retired to was in this neighborhood where they were positioned right where people entered this little tract of homes, so they could always see who was coming and going. But then their neighborhood was also kind of a circle, and there was this big, they lived at a golf course, and there was a big putting green and some tennis courts behind their house, but they were up on a hill so they could overlook it, and they could see the neighbors' houses on the other side, and they could see into people's houses a lot. And my grandma would just stand there in the mornings, just drinking her tea and just like, oh, I see Betty's got a new whatever, or so-and-so's kids are over, and that kind of thing. And it's just like, in these neighborhoods, you do get, there's always someone who has that kind of position where they're able to see what's happening, and they do, they take advantage of that. And it just really reminded me of of listening to my grandma give the report about what was happening in the neighborhood, you know.
Well, and I one of the things I like about Sel is that she does have like a demonstrable effect on the plot. She isn't just a commentator.
Right.
She's very much like she gets involved and she gets increasingly involved and like she's instrumental in bringing him information about what's happening. She's instrumental. She goes to bail Lisa out of prison when Lisa gets arrested. You know, she is very much a part of the story and a very important part of the story. She gets very well integrated into it. And I also like the fact, because it's a very masculine film in a lot of ways, right? And because the main character is Jimmy Stewart. But then you've got her and like Stella and Lisa, so Thelma Ritter and Grace Kelly, kind of beginning to bounce off of each other. Mm-hmm. And there's a great section that is one of my favorite moments in the film where they begin debating how you get rid of a body. and it's just like, okay, so if he got rid of her, like how did he get rid of her? And they're talking about like, you know, him, you know, he took suitcases out, he did this, he did that. And they're beginning to be like, so what would you put it in a bathtub? And then you would need it like a saw. And he is listening to the two of them debate what's happened, right? And you get this moment of like him just sort of staring at the two of them as they're talking about this really violent murder and like where the head must be. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff. And you've got this like, you know, cute little Brooklyn lady and Grace Kelly who are having this conversation. And it's this moment of like, he's horrified by it. He's been speculating about like the possibility of his neighbor being a killer. And he's increasingly horrified by what the two women are talking about. And one of the things I really like about it is that we talked about this last week, bloodlust in women is just very present. And I have heard like more women being willing to talk about these violent crimes than men are. And it's just mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, so how would you go about getting rid of a body?
Yeah.
It's such a sharp and intelligent scene. It's very much like, yes, this is exactly what these two women would be talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so a couple of months ago when the whole like, how often do men think about the Roman Empire thing was going around. And then it became, well, what is it? What's the women's version of the Roman Empire? And I think someone said something about reality TV and I was just like, no, that's not it. And I was talking to a friend and we both were like, no, it's murder. It was like for women, it's murder. And I was telling a group of friends about this and it was a mixed group. There were men and women in this group. And one of the guys goes, do you think about being murdered or murdering people? I'm like, yeah, both. And all the guys were just so like, what? And all the women were like, yep, that is accurate. That is 100% true. This is what we think about.
How would you get rid of the body? Let's talk about it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And and so the fact that, and this is the thing I say all the time, women don't change, people don't change. And so you have these two women having this conversation in 1954 that is still very reminiscent of conversations that I have with my friends now in 2024, 70 years later. So
it's this practicality too. Yeah. Like there's like, okay, well, we can imagine that he killed his wife, but if he did kill his wife, we have to figure out how did he get rid of her?
Right.
If her body's not there anymore. And one of the things I also like is that they're pretty much right. Like their speculation is actually pretty much what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like I think part of the reason that, at least for me, part of the reason that I get a little bit obsessed about learning about and listening and to podcasts and reading about murders is because it's helpful to know what to prepare for and how to avoid being murdered. But it's also just interesting.
It's helpful to figure out when you kill someone. Got to figure out how to get rid of the body.
Yeah. I mean, that could be something that needs to happen at some point. You never know.
Well, and to bring this back to Hitchcock, one of the things that Hitchcock does very well in a lot of his films and in a lot of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes as well, is to get at exactly that. The way, the attitude that women in particular take to murdering people. Mm-hmm. And he does it in a couple of films where it's like, yeah, there's that humor to it, that speculation about it, that like, okay, we're going to be practical about this.
Yeah.
And it's very clever. It's very true.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And yeah, so I love that scene between Stella and Lisa, because it's just, it reminds me of conversations that I have with my friends.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anything else to say about Rear Window?
I mean, of course, there'd be tons to say about Rear Window, but not in terms of this conversation. It is, if anyone is not, again, this is another one. If you've not seen Rear Window, dear God, see Rear Window. Like, even if you know the entire plot of the film, it is such, like, every time I watch it, I'm like, this is just, I'm mad about how good this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well structured. It's so fascinating. One of the great things about it is that you actually can, like, if you've seen it a couple of times, you do actually see other things. You see little bits that filter in with, like, you know, his observation of the courtyard, the little clues that get picked up, the relationships between the characters. Watch it with the subtitles on, because you get like snatches of conversation that you might not notice otherwise, because it's just part of the ambiance, but it builds so incredibly well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so good. Not really streaming anywhere for free right now, but available to rent all the time. And it pops up all over the place from here and from time to time. So,
and fairly recently released in 4K as well. And it's gorgeous. Blu-ray and 4K.
Ooh, I haven't gotten that. I have a digital version of it on my Vudu, but 4K, I'll have to get that.
It's the Alfred Hitchcock Classics Collection are slowly releasing particularly a lot of his very big films.
Ooh, fun. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap things up for this week, Gal.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We especially would like to thank our patrons who help keep the show going. They are Abby, Ollie, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Karen, Cariata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. Thank you all so much for your support. If you would like to join them and become a patron too, you can go to patreon.com/citizendame to sign up. And anybody who has recently signed up, if you have not gotten your button stickers, whatever that we owe you, please let us know.
Yeah.
And we will get those out to you right away. There are other ways you can support us too. We have our Etsy shop, etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod, and Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. And then there's other ways that you can connect with us too. We're always available by email, citizendamepod@gmail.com. And be sure to check out our website, citizendamepod.com, where we have some stuff coming your way. I did a review this week of Immacula, if you'd like to read what I had to say about that. And there's more coming your way soon. And then you can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter and Instagram, at Citizen Dame Pod, and Blue Sky. Also, you can find us, Citizen Dame Pod. And then on Letterboxd, we are a Letterboxd HQ, and you can find us at Citizen Dame. We are also available individually. Lauren, where are you?
I am on Instagram and Letterboxd mostly, at LH Business.
And I am on all the socials at Karen M. Peterson. And that's going to wrap things up for this week. Thank you so much, and we will catch you next time.
Bye.
You know, I think you're right. I think there is going to be trouble around here.
I knew it.
Oh, do you ever heat that stuff?
Gives your circulation something to fight.
Oh, I see.
What kind of trouble?
Lisa Fremont.
You kidding? She's a beautiful young girl, and you're a reasonably healthy young man.
She expects me to marry her.
That's normal.
I don't want to.
What's abnormal?
I'm not ready for marriage.
Every man's ready for marriage when the right girl comes along. And Lisa Fremont is the right girl for any man with half a brain who can get one eye open.